in a real-world setting and see the effects. The Stanford data was gathered at two similar San Jose elementary schools. Researchers first carefully assessed the baseline level of aggressive behavior in 192 third and fourth graders through playground observations and interviews. Then they introduced a curriculum at one school meant to encourage children to cut back on video games and watch less television. Two-thirds of the pupils agreed to participate in an initial 10-day effort to turn off their televisions, which was monitored by slips signed by parents. Over half of them limited their television viewing to less than 7 hours per week during the next 20 weeks. After 20 weeks, the researchers found a 40% reduction in physical aggression and a 50% reduction in the level of verbal aggression in the overall population at the experimental school compared with the other that did not follow the curriculum. The children who were the most aggressive at the outset of the study had the most to gain and did in fact show the greatest benefit. The researchers also noted a significant reduction in obesity and overeating problems in the school where the curriculum was introduced. Remember, according to the U.S. Department of Education, in 2007 alone, there were 63 kids dead by violence in our schools and 250,000 seriously injured. However, it has been over 50 years since a single child has been killed or seriously injured by school fire. This means that the likelihood of your child being killed or injured by school violence is thousands of times greater than the probability of them being killed or injured in a school fire. Thus, we have the moral obligation to spend at least as much time and energy on school violence as we do on school fires. Every school has sprinklers, alarms, drills, and extinguishers in preparation for fires. So why don't we prepare for what is killing our kids? If we had 250,000 kids seriously injured by school fire every year, and we knew that fire drills would reduce that by 40%, would we have a moral obligation to conduct fire drills? You bet. So, if we have 250,000 kids a year seriously injured by school violence, and we knew that educating them about the health impact of media violence would reduce that by 40%, would we have a moral obligation to conduct media violence education? You better believe it. When I was in first grade, and the teacher told us that cigarettes could kill people, I thought immediately of my dad who smoked. I loved my dad and did not want him to die, so I hid his cigarettes. He convinced me that that was not a good idea. The generation in elementary school that was first taught about the health risks of tobacco is the same one that grew up and played pin the tail on the donkey with the tobacco industry. Today, we are on the threshold of a generation that is being informed of the health impact of media violence, the result of which, if corrective measures are implemented, will be a major victory for America's children and for the American people. We have never had anything that demonstrated a fraction of the result of the Stanford study. We have wonderful programs in place, such as aggression replacement, peer mediation, DARE, drug abuse resistance education, and GREAT, gang resistance education and training. All outstanding efforts, but not one has demonstrated a fraction of the impact of simply teaching kids to just turn off the television, turn off the toxic culture. Here is what I call my milk and cookies equation. Say there is a kid hooked on some kind of an addictive drug. We could give him all the milk and cookies in the world, but he would still do everything he could to get his fix. If the drug were suddenly yanked out of his life, he would suffer and struggle until he returned to normal. It is only then, when he is no longer hungry for his fix, that he would be ready to accept our milk and cookies. The Stanford study made clear the positive impact that happens when we take the addictive drug of violent media out of children's lives. I had the opportunity to work with a wonderful lady who runs a state-sponsored school in Canada for violent Aboriginal, what we would call Native American, boys from the backwoods country. The boys in this Canadian school were placed there because they were prone to violence, so much so that the Mounties had to be called almost daily. The program was designed so that kids would attend the school for a short while and then get cycled out at the end of the semester. With one group of boys, the principal removed television and all violent video games from their lives. Remember that the Stanford study found that the most violent kids were impacted the greatest when television was taken out of their lives. At the Canadian school, there was a 90% reduction in violence among the boys who had television and video games removed, compared to any previous group of boys who had been through that school. Today, this is a K-12 curriculum that is essentially free and available online, and the Delta Schoolcraft Intermediate School District in Escanaba, Michigan, is now the national distributor for the Take the Challenge TV Turnoff curriculum. You can get information about this curriculum at www.takethechallengenow.net. Hollywood versus America. Anyone who thinks the media has nothing to do with it is an idiot. The Dream Factory has become the Poison Factory. Michael Medved, Hollywood versus America. Has there always been violence? Will there always be violence? Of course. But we know now that when the ingredient of media violence is added to everything else, violence skyrockets. After the slaughter at Columbine High School, the president of CBS Television made a slip. When asked if he thought the media had anything to do with the Columbine School massacre, he answered, "Anyone who thinks the media has nothing to do with it is an idiot." How much clearer can it get? Shortly after the Littleton killings, the California Senate unanimously approved a resolution on media violence. By chance, did you read or hear anything about this unanimously approved Senate resolution? Probably not, since it was censored. Here is what Ted Turner said. "Television violence is the single most significant factor contributing to violence in America." He didn't say it was the only factor. He said it is the most significant one. Now, if Ted Turner knows that, but he keeps selling it to kids, what does that make him? A hypocrite? A child abuser? An accessory to murder? So why does he keep doing it? Money. It makes him rich. Rich like a drug dealer. Does a drug dealer know that he is hurting people? Of course. Does he care? Not one bit. Do the media people know that they are hurting people? Of course. They even admit it. Do they care? Apparently not. We are dealing with an industry functioning at the moral level of drug dealers. In fact, one of their objectives is to convince us to legalize drugs. Once they sell out to drug dealer logic, then the next natural step is to legalize drugs and identify with the dealers and other criminals. How low can they go? There is a wonderful, insightful book by Michael Medved called Hollywood versus America, and I encourage you to read it. I have been on Michael's national radio show several times. He is a brilliant man who writes a weekly column for USA Today and is one of our nation's most respected commentators on the media. Hollywood versus America. That really says it all. On one occasion, I was on CNN's Larry King show, and then later served as a member of a panel at a national conference chaired by Larry King. He is a great man, and his program was not hurting anyone, except maybe the occasional crooked politician. Still, he is part of the media industry, so his first response to its culpability was denial. At one point in the program, Larry King said, "Colonel, there's violence in the Bible. Why don't we take the Bible away from kids, too?" The difference, I told him, is that the American Medical Association has not identified the Bible as a key causal factor in half of all the murders in America. No one should be talking about young children and the written word because they cannot process it until they are around 8 years old. What they see goes into their eyes. It is decoded in their logic center, and it trickles and filters into their emotional center. I went on to explain oral communication. No one should be talking about the spoken word, as it cannot be processed until around age 4. Spoken language goes into the kid's ears, where it is decoded in the logic center, and then trickles and filters into the emotional center. Then I explained the dramatic difference with what the child sees. Violent visual imagery can be fully processed as young as 14 months. The images seen by an infant go straight into the eyes and then into the emotional center, where they have an immediate impact on how that baby views the world. Now, one or two violent shows will not immediately transform a young mind, but the average child in America spends more time in front of the tube than he does in school. In school, he learns reading, writing, arithmetic, and every other academic subject, but it is from television that he learns about death, horror, and destruction. Violent imagery can have a profound and tragic impact on a child. Comparing it to Grimm's fairy tales or comparing it to the Bible is like comparing cigarettes and chocolate. Lauren Christensen knows a young couple whose daughter was 17 months old on September 11, 2001. Like most people in America, the couple sat transfixed by the horrific images on their television. Planes flying into the sides of the Twin Towers. Smoke. Screams. Panic. The collapse of buildings. More screams, sirens, more panic, the urgency in the reporters' voices, and billowing black smoke and lapping flames shooting from the Pentagon. Their 17-month-old daughter watched too, sitting amongst her toys on the floor, her large, innocent eyes glued to the violent images. Within an hour, she began to whine and wanted to be held, and by mid-afternoon, the little girl was clearly anxious and clingy. Her eyes large with fear. It finally dawned on her mother that her daughter had been watching the television screen too. After that, the parents no longer watched the news when she could see it. Here's another look at how kids process information at different ages. Your 8-year-old is away at camp. He gets a letter or an email from home that informs him that the dog was hit by a car and died. Your 4-year-old child comes home from daycare. And you sit him down and tell him that the dog was hit by a car and died. Your 2-year-old child is standing out in the front yard and witnesses a car run over the family dog. The dog whines, cries, and dies as it messes itself and bleeds a big bloody spot in the middle of the road. All the while, the child watches with wide eyes. Which do you think is going to have the most profound impact on the child? Obviously, the violent visual imagery is much more harmful to the child, both because of the age at which the child processes the information and because of the visual nature of the information. Learning violence. We are biologically primed to seek survival data. Base is the slave that pays. Shakespeare, King Henry IV. The International Committee of the Red Cross invited me to join a handful of experts in Geneva, Switzerland, for a conference on the impact of media violence on atrocities worldwide. One of the attendees was a British biologist who discussed how living creatures are biologically primed to learn certain things at specific ages. For example, if a little bird does not hear its species song in the first year of its life, it will never sing it later. This is because the bird is primed to learn only one song, and if the baby bird fails to learn the song when it is supposed to, it never will. Human beings have a capacity to learn violence in the same way. We do not need violence any more than we need crack, nicotine, or alcohol. But if we are exposed to it at a young age, we become hooked. Humans are biologically primed to seek survival data. And violence is the ultimate survival data. What is the one event on the playground guaranteed to draw every child like a magnet? A fight. Children will fight to see a fight. Because if there is violence in their environment, they must witness it so that they can adapt to it as quickly as possible. Your brain, a self-programming computer that fills the space between your ears, is designed to help you survive. You do not have strong limbs, deadly fangs, or sharp claws, but you do have a brain, and your survival depends on it adapting quickly to changes in your environment. If violence occurs in your presence, then you have to learn to run or use violence in self-defense. Many kids run, or they become fearful and depressed. A few, however, learn to adapt to violence and to use it. When a boy between the ages of 2 and 5 years of age watches his father beat his mother every night, he probably learns to hate that behavior and to hate his father. 15 years later, when he is grown and has a wife and kids, it is probable that under stress, he will beat his wife too. We know that not every kid who watches his father beat his mother will grow up to be a spousal abuser, but that kid is more likely to repeat the behavior than one whose father did not abuse his mother. This is because any behavior observed in the first 6 or 7 years of a kid's life is hard to unlearn. As the child's brain develops, Mother Nature is a harsh gardener, pruning the unused, fertilizing the useful. The 7-year-old does not hide his eyes as his father strikes his mother, but he huddles in the corner, watching and learning. His biological drive for survival and to adapt to his environment demands that he watch and learn. Once puberty begins, a second biological drive kicks in, one that is immensely attractive: sex, procreation. Say you show a porn movie to a 3-year-old. Don't do it. It's not good for him. But the truth is that the kid could care less. He would just flip to another channel since the images wouldn't mean anything to him. Show porn to a 12-year-old, however, and he is riveted. His heartbeat goes up, his respiration goes up, and other things go up. He has an immediate and profound biological response to the pornographic images. Violent visual imagery is to a 2-year-old as pornography is to a 12-year-old. The 2-year-old boy's heart rate goes up, his respiration goes up, and he is riveted. It is what he is biologically primed to seek. I had an opportunity to talk with one of the vice presidents at Random House, the publisher of Stop Teaching Our Kids to Kill. He told me that he believes that television is the single greatest threat to the book industry today. When television viewing goes up, reading goes down. When the number of television channels goes up, the number of newspapers goes down. We spent 5,000 years struggling to become a literate society, and now, for the first time in history, we're stepping backwards. I had the occasion to be interviewed by Katie Couric on NBC's The Today Show. She looked at me with those big eyes, which were kind of distracting, and asked, "Colonel, I watched all that stuff when I was a kid, and I'm not a killer. Why should I worry about my kids?" I said, "Katie, when I was a kid, I never buckled my seatbelt, and I'm just fine. So why should I buckle up my kids?" "Oh," she said. Although she was playing devil's advocate, there are many parents who live by that logic. Imagine some bubba from my home state of Arkansas driving through your state with his kids in the back seat, unbuckled and bouncing around like high-speed molecules. A police officer pulls him over, says, "Sorry, but I'm going to have to give you a ticket because your kids are not buckled in. It's the law." Not surprisingly, my homeboy is going to try to get out of that ticket with a little Arkansas logic. "Well, officer," he'll say, "when I was a kid, I never buckled my seatbelt, and look at me. I'm just fine. In fact, everybody I know never buckled their seatbelts. And I bet you never buckled your seatbelt. And look at you. You're just fine, too." Do you think that logic would get him out of a seatbelt ticket? I don't think so either. In fact, old Bubba should get 2 tickets, one for not buckling his kids in, and the other for being felony stupid, as we call it in Arkansas. I have to admit that at one time I was felony stupid. I heard about the issue of media violence years ago, but I just ignored it. I thought that since it had not hurt me, why should I worry about it hurting my kids? Today I look back and I am ashamed of what I let my kids watch. By the grace of God, they turned out all right. Most kids do, in spite of us. But what a stupid risk. It is important that we learn from our mistakes. My mom did. She'd never buckle us kids into our seatbelts, and we turned out okay. But when my mom had grandbabies, she got religion. One time, when my kids were little, she came to visit me. I was a tough paratrooper then, a sergeant, a man of the world. I went to the airport to pick up my mama, as my two little boys bounced around in the back seat. The first thing she did, after she got in the car, was to try to take charge. She turned to me and said, "Dave, buckle those babies up." Well, I figured I didn't have to take that anymore. So I said, "But Ma, you never buckled us up when we were kids," and bam! She smacked me right upside of the head. End of discussion. That is the kind of grandparent I want to be. No, I didn't thump my kids like Mom, but I did bribe them. My wife and I have cut a deal with our kids, and they fully agree. We paid them $1,000 a year towards the grandbaby's college funds for every year they promised to keep them television-free for the first 6 or 7 years of their life. Keeping those kids violence-free is one of the greatest gifts we can give them during these most impressionable years. When the military wants to put together an effective psychological operations message, they often go to those who make commercials, the people on Madison Avenue. In the field of behavioral sciences, more money has been invested in designing commercials than in any other area. It is not a perfect science. If it were, we would all be eating Big Macs 3 times a day. But it is not for a lack of trying. Madison Avenue has spent billions of dollars to determine the right color and shape of a product, the most effective number of times to show the commercials, and the right flicker rate to ensure that your child walks away from the television screen with two things in his mind: a desire to overeat and dissatisfaction with his possessions. Besides a pronounced reduction in violence, the Stanford study showed two other interesting side effects when television viewing was eliminated for a semester: a significant decrease in obesity and a decrease in nagging parents for toys. There is a national problem of obesity among our kids, not only because they sit on their chubby tails for long periods doing nothing but watching television or playing video games, but also because they are victims of junk food commercials. One key factor in the obesity equation is that they sit and watch television commercials that advertise tantalizing burgers, shakes, sugar-coated cereals, fat-laden chips, and sugar-saturated sodas. Television gives our kids massive amounts of toxic and addictive violence and tweaks their minds with sophisticated psychology to make them overeat and feel a sense of dissatisfaction with their possessions. It is imperative that we protect them during the first 6 or 7 years of their lives. Violent female role models and an explosion of violent girls. O woman, woman, when too ill thy mind is bent, all hell contains no fouler fiend. Homer, The Odyssey. Why do you think males are the biggest perpetrators of violent behavior? Testosterone poisoning? That might very well be part of the reason. But arguably, a more significant factor comes from the impact of role models. At about the age of 2, a little boy and a little girl look at their naked selves in a mirror and discover their specific sexes. Wow, look at that. Shortly after this discovery, they start seeking same-sex role models, and they usually find it in the media. The little boy turns on the television, and he sees male behavior manifested in violence. When he sees this depicted repeatedly on the tube, he begins to think that that is what the male species is all about. Females are most often depicted in the media as passive and helpless victims. When a little girl sees that over and over, that behavior becomes a role model to her. The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles TV show was the last generation of all-male preschool violent role models. They were replaced with the Power Rangers, half of which were females. Let's call it gender equity in preschool violent role models. That generation grew up with the Power Rangers, which cocked and primed them for Xena the Warrior Princess and Buffy the Vampire Slayer and many others. It was even predicted that there would be an increase in violent behavior by young females from their exposure to this bombardment of violent female role models in the media. Well, the best measure of a scientific theory is its power to predict. In just 10 years, from 1990 to 1999, the juvenile female aggravated assault rate took a 57% hike. Juvenile weapons violations for females went up 44%. Why are these numbers so dramatic? To answer that, consider what the tobacco industry did. For years, they primarily marketed tobacco to males. But then one day, the ad men said, wait a minute, half the population out there isn't smoking as much as they should. We need to hit them too. So they started marketing to females. And a few years later, there was a resultant explosion of cancer among women. It was even predicted that if there was an increase in smoking among females, that their cancer rates would soar, and it did. A few years later, it was predicted that if there was an increase in violent female role models in the media, violent female behavior would soar, and it did. Making the media link. Ask what they watch. Find out the cause of this effect, or rather say, the cause of this defect. Shakespeare, Hamlet. Police officers investigating crimes committed by kids, or even by mentally disturbed adults, who have committed, say, massive workplace massacres, theater massacres, or school massacres, such as the Sandy Hook school massacre, should ask the perpetrator if their crime reminded them of a specific video game, television program, or movie. They should not be asked if they were inspired by a movie or a video game, as that often makes them angry. Many of them have great pride in what they have done, and they do not want to give credit elsewhere. For example, when the detective investigating the Paducah, Kentucky school massacre asked the young child if he was inspired by the movie Basketball Diaries, the kid became enraged. Later, he told his psychologist, "This is the only real adventure I've ever had, and now they are trying to accuse me of being a copycat." The two Columbine killers even said in their videotape that no one should think they were copycats. "Those other kids were the copycats," they said. "We had this idea first." These killers denied they were copycats because deep inside they knew they were. The detective in Paducah backed off and then came back with a softer and slightly different approach. "What movie was it like?" he asked. And just like that, the kid connected the dots. That is the key question officers should ask. What video game or movie was it like? Brain scan research, the final nail in Hollywood's coffin. Next time you find your child playing a violent video game, or watching an action movie, think, because you want them to be able to do so. Center for Successful Parenting, brochure on Indiana University Brain Scan Study. The final nail in Hollywood's coffin will be the brain scan studies that are now coming out around the world. Once upon a time, I could show you two x-rays, one of a smoker's lung and one of a healthy lung. End of discussion. Now I can show you two brain scans, one of a healthy child and one of a child whacked out from media violence. End of discussion. This research has been replicated in Texas and Japan, and as time goes by, we will see more and more of it. But the true pioneer in this field was the Center for Successful Parenting, which funded the brain scan research conducted by the Indiana University Medical Department. Note that this is medical research, I cannot overemphasize how important it is that we listen to the AMA and not Hollywood or the video game industry. When it comes to our children's health, we must listen to the medical professors, not the journalism professors. I'd like to tell a little story to demonstrate how foolish I think it is to give any credibility to the industry that sells this stuff, or to the journalist or the sociology professor, instead of listening to the medical profession. A police officer told me about two felons fleeing in a car. When the police finally got the car stopped, there were cops in front of the suspect's car. So if it pulled forward, it would be a clear deadly force threat. The officer said that he went up to the driver's side window with his gun drawn. It was a hot day and the windows were open. So he commanded the driver, "Stop the car or I will shoot." He said, "I distinctly heard the guy in the passenger seat say, 'Go ahead, man, he won't shoot.' So the car started to pull forward, and blam, blam, I put two holes in the driver. Then I distinctly heard Einstein in the passenger seat say, 'Whoa, sorry, man.'" The moral of the story is this: be very careful who you get your advice from. If you are getting advice about the health effects of screen violence from Hollywood, the TV industry, the video game industry, the journalism professor, or the sociology professor, then you are about as swift as the driver of that car. So listen to what the Indiana University Medical Department's brain scan research has to tell us. The following is an extract from the Center for Successful Parenting brochure, designed to inform the public about this important research. Parental warning: violent media exposure has a negative effect on your child's brain. You probably think that the video game your child is playing every afternoon isn't affecting their behavior. Think again. Researchers at the Indiana University School of Medicine recently conducted a study that demonstrated otherwise. The study: over a 2-year period, researchers at Indiana University School of Medicine studied two groups of adolescents between the ages of 13 and 17. The first group was made up of normal teenagers. The second group consisted of teenagers who had been diagnosed with disruptive brain disorder, or DBD. A DBD diagnosis is given to children who have shown significant aggressive behavior and resistance to authority. Subjects from the two groups were paired according to age, gender, and IQ. Step 1. In step 1 of the study, the teenagers and their parents were surveyed about the teenagers' exposure to violence in video games, movies, and television. Some of the teenagers had viewed a lot of media violence throughout their lives, and some had viewed very little. Step 2. In step 2, the teens were tested in a very sophisticated MRI called fMRI. The fMRI produces pictures of the activity in the logical part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex. This part of the brain produces what we think of as adult behavior. The prefrontal cortex is responsible for controlling behavior, moderating impulsive urges, thinking about future consequences, and decision-making. If children do not fully develop their prefrontal cortex, they can become problem adults. The brain scans. The two sets of fMRI pictures or brain scans show the differences in brain activity between teenagers who had been exposed to a lot of media violence and those who had been exposed to very little. These brain scan images can be found on the PDF included with this audiobook. To understand the pictures, you need to know that the scans on the left are teenagers with low exposure to media violence, and the scans on the right are teenagers with high exposure. The larger the black area, the more brain activity is occurring in the logical adult part of the brain. This is the area that parents want to develop in their children. Conversely, the smaller the black area, the less brain activity has taken place. the video game. The first set of scans on the PDF included with this audiobook shows brain activity when the teenagers were viewing a video game inside the fMRI. The low media exposure teens are using more of the logical part of their brains than the high exposure teens. Decision making. The next set of scans, also found in the PDF, shows brain activity during a decision-making exercise called go-no-go. When it comes to looking into the future, weighing consequences, and making decisions, the low media violence exposure group is using a lot of the logical part of their brain. The high media violence exposure group is using very little. The conclusion. After studying and comparing all of the brain scans of all of the teenagers, what did the researchers conclude? The most surprising result was that normal teenagers with a high amount of exposure to media violence had reduced activity in the logical part of the brain similar to those of teens with disruptive behavior disorder. All of the teens with DBD, disruptive behavior disorder, had less activity in the logical part of their brains than normal teens. The more violence they had seen, the more pronounced the deficit. The normal teens that had seen very little media violence had the most activity in the logical part of the brain, the part that parents want to develop in their children. All of these results indicate that there is a correlation between the amount of media violence children see and their ability to think logically. Next time you find your child playing a violent video game or watching an action movie, think, because you want them to be able to do so. What you can do as a parent. Provide a media-free zone in your child's bedroom. No TV, video games, computer, or DVD players. Reduce the exposure children have to violent content in movies, TV, and video games. Refuse to expose children under the age of 7 to any violent content in entertainment. Make TV viewing a family activity and have the TV in a common area. Turn off the television before school. Don't let your children play violent video games. Enforce the video game rating system as a bare minimum standard. Know the content of movies before your child goes to the theater. Don't let a child under the age of 17 go to an R-rated movie or play an M-rated video game. Monitor your child's use of the internet. Don't let your child have unlimited access to the internet. As a result of this research, we now understand that media violence stunts or retards kids' brain development. Kids with violent TV, movie, and video game exposure had reduced cognitive brain function. And media violence makes violent brains. Violent TV, movies, and video game exposure had an effect on normal kids that made their brain scans the same as kids with documented, diagnosed, disruptive behavior disorder. The future. Peace warriors and a reckoning for the media. Yet sometimes glimpses on my sight, through present wrong, the eternal right. And step by step, since time began, I see the steady gain of man. John Greenleaf Whittier, The Chapel of the Hermit. Kids' access to violent media is not the only factor contributing to raging, escalating violence. There is also child abuse, poverty, gangs, drugs, breakdown of moral structure, lack of moral training, easy access to weapons, and mental illness. These are all factors, too. Keep in mind, though, what Ted Turner and the American Academy of Pediatrics say is the most remediable, the most significant factor, media violence. Yes, you can just turn media violence off in your house, but there will be millions of other households where kids are watching it because their parents allow them to. They are watching it because it is available to them. The good news is that we have a joint moral responsibility to fix this wrong, and we are working hard to get more and more people to join the fight with us. 100 years ago, it was legal to sell alcohol to a 9-year-old, and the alcohol industry did exactly that, and they even murdered people in their battle to keep doing it. 50 years ago, it was legal to sell tobacco to a 6-year-old, and the tobacco industry did, and they had an army of people battling any law that would keep tobacco out of the hands of kids. Why did the tobacco and alcohol industry work so hard to keep selling their product to underage customers? Money. The younger the customers are when exposed to the toxic and addictive substances, the more likely they are to have an addictive response for a lifetime. Today, the television, movie, and video game industries are doing the same thing as they sell their toxic and addictive substance to kids. Just as tobacco manifested in an explosion of cancer and heart disease, media violence has manifested itself into the most violent times in peacetime history. Even if we could stop all the media violence today, it would take at least 15 years to see long-term positive results, though we would experience an immediate impact, just as we found in the Stanford study when television viewing was curtailed for one semester. I truly believe that we are on the threshold of positive change, but it is going to take time. The brain scan research findings are coming out, and schools across America are embracing the Take the Challenge curriculum and investing themselves in it. Their curriculum has been released nationwide and is available to anyone in any school through the www.takethechallengenow.net website. To win this battle, we need peace warriors. We have peace officers in America, and we have peacekeepers in distant lands. We have activists, educators, students, and parents, all working together for peace. You have a choice between the culture of death or the side of the peace warriors. Choose your side. The peace warriors will succeed. And for those who sold death and destruction to our children, there will be a reckoning. But first, there will be many violent years in front of us. Years that will make what we have experienced thus far pale in comparison. The kids who gave us Jonesboro in the middle school, Columbine in the high school, and Virginia Tech in college now give us Aurora, Colorado in the theaters and Sandy Hook in our first grade classrooms. We have dark and desperate times in front of us. We can survive those years. But to do so, we need educated, informed warriors. Warriors who remember the dead children they have held in their arms and who understand the causes of violence in our society. For they are the sparrows around God's door. He will lift them up in His own great banner. But the folks who made them suffer so sore, He will deal with them in a different manner. Stephen Vincent Benet. Section 4. The Price of Combat, After the Smoke Clears. To live as a warrior. So live your life that the fear of death can never enter your heart. Trouble no one about their religion. Respect others in their view, and demand that they respect yours. Love your life. Perfect your life. Beautify all things in your life. Seek to make your life long and its purpose in the service of your people. Prepare a noble death song for the day when you go over the great divide. Always give a word or a sign of salute when meeting or passing a friend, even a stranger, when in a lonely place. Show respect to all people and grovel to none. When you arise in the morning, give thanks for the food and for the joy of living. If you see no reason for giving thanks, the fault lies only in yourself. Abuse no one and nothing, for abuse turns the wise ones to fools and robs the spirit of his vision. Live right, so when it comes your time to die, you will not be like those whose hearts are filled with the fear of death, who weep and pray for a little more time, to live their lives over again in a different way. Sing your death song and die like a hero going home. Tecumseh, the great Shawnee warrior and statesman, courtesy of the United Tribe of Shawnee Indians. Chapter 1. Relief, self-blame, and other emotions. My world was turned inside out. The mind is its own place, and in itself can make heaven of hell a hell of heaven. Milton, Paradise Lost. Thank God it wasn't me. Then my world was turned inside out. One of the guys that I had come to know and respect, and I called a friend, was killed. He died in front of me, and I couldn't do anything about it. All of the ways I'd dealt with death up to that time were of no use to me now. I felt guilty that I couldn't do anything to prevent it. I felt better him than me, and then I felt guilty about feeling that. I felt alone. I felt the loss of a friend. I felt that if it happened to him, it could happen to me. I was sickened by the way he died. I was pissed that the enemy could do this to my friend. But we were in the middle of a firefight. I didn't have time to dwell on it, so I had to put off feeling anything until later. At his memorial service, I cried. Tom Hain, Vietnam veteran. The first response of most people upon seeing sudden violent death is relief. They are relieved that it did not happen to them. Say your partner or buddy is killed and your first thought is, thank God it wasn't me. Later, when you reflect on your first response, how do you think that will make you feel? Guilty. You are consumed with guilt because no one ever told you that the normal response of most people upon seeing sudden violent death is to focus on themselves and to feel relief. The puppy is in charge, your midbrain, that part concerned about your survival, and it sends out a message, hey, that could have been me. The day after a major school massacre, I was in the school explaining the debriefing process to the teachers who had just survived that horrific event. I explained to them that they should not feel guilty about any initial concern they had for themselves during the tragedy, because such an emotion was a perfectly normal response to such extraordinary violence. I told them that it is similar to when the flight attendant on an airliner tells them that if there is a sudden loss of cabin pressure, oxygen masks will drop down, and they should put on theirs before they help small children. The first response of the organism is to take care of itself first, and that is okay, because that is simply the law of nature. After I explained this to those teachers, several of them laid their heads down on the table and began to sob with relief. They were relieved and comforted to learn that what they had experienced was normal. If you know in advance that it is normal upon seeing trauma and death to think, thank God it wasn't me, then that thought will not have the power to hurt you later. That is the first debriefing principle. You are only as sick as your secrets. Just like when you know ahead of time that a loss of bowel and bladder control is normal, then that too no longer has the power to hurt you. The Catholic Church has understood this for over 1,000 years. They call it confession. They know that when you confess your secrets and lay them on the table, so to speak, you come to terms with them so that they have far less power over you. It's all my fault and the power of debriefing. With Plato's Republic and the Bible, Orestia, a trilogy of 3 plays about the hero cycle of Orestes, is one of the 3 most important works of Western literature. Orestes must avenge the murder of his father by killing his father's murderer, his mother. It drives him to psychosis. The conflict of the Orestia is between the ancient tribal code of vengeance and the new law of forgiveness. The ancient tribal gods of blood guilt are the Furies, who drive Orestes to mental illness through the violence he must do to fulfill their law of revenge. The new law is given by Athena, patron of the young democracy of Athens. She casts the deciding vote in the Athenian assembly to acquit Orestes of his guilt after a long and passionate discussion and trial, which frees him from his debilitating PTSD. The work ends with a hymn of praise to Holy Pythos. Pythos, not pathos. No, it's not divine mercy, not faith, not even justice. Pythos simply means dialogue. It is the power of telling our stories honestly in a trusted circle of compatriots. What a remarkably unmiraculous salvation, yet profound as grace. Men can be healed through telling their stories in community. Your book can be that community. No judgment, no condemnation, just the remarkable power of understanding. Alfred Lamott, Chaplain, Charles Wright Academy, Correspondence to Colonel Grossman. In the stress of a violent situation, the tendency to accept responsibility for what happened can be a powerful one. The midbrain can hit you with an "it's all my fault" response. For example, kids of recently divorced parents are often convinced, at some gut level, that the demise of the marriage is because of them. They think that if they had just been better kids, the divorce would not have happened. After one horrendous massacre at a middle school, many of the 11, 12, and 13-year-old children said, in their debriefings, that they believed that what had happened was all their fault. If I had just been nicer to him on the bus on Friday, maybe he wouldn't have been mad at us. If I had just said something to him in the hallway on Monday, maybe he wouldn't have done this. If I had not let the fire door shut behind us, if I had only pulled her down to the ground when I went down, on and on it went. If the kids were thinking this way, finding some convoluted probability path by which they could have prevented some aspect of what had happened, what do you suppose the teachers were thinking? They were eating themselves alive. This brings us to the second debriefing principle. Pain shared is pain divided. Say we are going to debrief the individuals involved in a police shooting. All the participants are present, including the dispatcher, who should always be included, since she could be living in hell and very much in need of filling in the gaps through the debriefing process. Many of the participants walk into the debriefing with the weight of the world on their shoulders, thinking, "It's all my fault." One might even say it out loud, "Man, I think this is all my fault." Another says, "No, I think it might be my fault." Still another says, "No, I blew it, because I should have done it differently." As the debriefing unfolds, each member figures out that it cannot be everyone's fault. And by the time it ends, each person walks out with his fair share of the blame. They came in with the weight of the world on their shoulders, and they walk out with their fair share. Pain shared is pain divided. Much more will be said about critical incident debriefings in later chapters, but for now it is important to point out that the authority, ability, and responsibility to divide the pain falls on the shoulders of the people who shared the event. They are the ones who can sift through what happened and help each person understand the totality of the event. They must be there for each other to divide the pain. By the way, the rest of the equation is joy shared is joy multiplied. First the pain is divided, and then the joy is multiplied. Sometimes just being educated about the "it's all my fault" response can help put things in perspective and send someone down the path of healing. Here is an example of a warrior who accepted responsibility for a death that was not his fault and found healing afterwards by being trained and informed about this common response. In 1992, I was a young correctional officer at the county jail. In the max unit was an inmate named Green. He was a sex offender and was in jail for a parole violation and was going to be sent back to prison in a few days. Green was a model inmate, never caused any problems, and did what he was asked to do. One day he asked how my day was and when I thought I would be back into the block. I told him that I would be back soon and asked if he needed something. Green stated that he had written a letter and that he would give it to me to mail later. I walked into the max cell block where Green was housed, just as another officer went into Green's cell to get him for commissary. I heard the officer yell, and I ran to the cell. I observed Green with a sheet around his neck, hanging. His face was purple, his eyes red and bulging, and his tongue was sticking out of the corner of his mouth. Me and the other officer got Green down and laid him on the cell floor. I started to do CPR on Green and was soon joined by another officer. Medical arrived and Green was transported to the hospital, where he was pronounced dead. I did not want to admit to my fellow officers that this incident had shook me up. I also felt responsible for not having found Green sooner, for not being able to save him or knowing that he intended to harm himself. He was one of the inmates in my block. Although Green had never threatened or shown any signs that he was planning to kill himself, I felt that it was my fault that he had done so. For months after the incident, Mr. Green would come to me in my dreams. He would be wearing a jail uniform and look just as he did the day we found him hanging. In my dreams, his face was purple and his eyes were red and bulging out of his head. He would try to speak to me, but could not because of his tongue hanging out of the corner of his mouth. I never told anyone before about this, not even my wife. I felt, as a law enforcement officer, such things should not bother me, and was ashamed that it did. I have been transferred out of the jail and into patrol for some time now. Since then, I have seen many dead and dying people, and none affected me the way Mr. Green did. The difference, I believe now, is because Mr. Green was an inmate who was in a cell block where it was my job to make sure things were okay and to protect the inmates. As the years went on, the dreams came less and less. Now I only dream about Mr. Green about 2 or 3 times a year. Sitting in your training the other day, it all came pouring back to me, and now I understand why I felt the way I did. I understand now that Mr. Green's death was not my fault, and that he chose his own fate. I believe Green asked what I had going on that day to find out the best time to hang himself and prevent me from interrupting him. I feel that I have come to accept this memory, and I don't think I will have any more visits from Mr. Green. Thank you ever so much for helping me put this incident to rest. Correspondence to Colonel Grossman. Thank God it wasn't you. To each his sufferings, all are men, condemned alike to groan. The tender for another's pain, the unfeeling for his own. Thomas Gray, On a Distant Prospect. Although I was living in Jonesboro, Arkansas, at the time my wife and I heard about the school massacre that happened there from my aunt, who called us from Florida. When she told me that she had just heard on CNN that there was a mass murder in a middle school in Jonesboro, my first thought was of my son, who was attending middle school there. I turned on CNN and there it was. My God. A mass murder in the middle school in our town. I was paralyzed. I didn't know what to do. My wife told me that I needed to go there, but what could I do, I asked. She told me that I could help and gave me a nudge out the door. I rushed to my son's school, only to discover that the massacre had not happened there, but rather at another middle school. I sped over to that one and spent the entire day and evening working with a group of magnificent people and helping to train and prepare mental health professionals. In my own hometown, I was applying the lessons of mass critical incident debriefings learned from the battlefield. When I got home about 1 o'clock in the morning, I headed straight to my boy's bedroom. He was a tall, gangly kid then, but I rolled him out of his bunk and hugged him as hard as I could, saying to myself, "Thank God it wasn't you." There were probably few parents in Jonesboro who did not do the same thing that night. My co-author said that he did it often as a police officer. On one occasion, for example, he found a dead 1-month-old baby in a chest of drawers in a rundown apartment. Christensen's son was just a year old at that time, and that boy got a big hug from his dad that night, and he whispered, "Thank God it wasn't you." If you've not said it, can you understand how somebody would? It is important to understand that you could utter those words and that it is okay if you do. And if it is okay for you to say it to them, then it is okay for them to say it to you. After a horrific experience, such as the loss of a partner or buddy, it can be a powerful shock to hear yourself think, "Thank God it wasn't me." Then the shock changes.